Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight, we present excerpts from four speakers at a conference earlier this week that sought to examine the current state and possible future of Iran, 23 years after the revolution that ousted the Shah and replaced him with an Islamic Republic. Some of the major issues discussed were the prospects for political change in Iran and Iran in relation to neighboring countries. Among the speakers on the first question were Professor David Menashri from Tel Aviv University and Professor Hushong Chehabi from Boston University's Center for International Relations. We'll first hear analysis from Professors Menashri and Chehabi, followed by two views of the regional perspective from Professors Nasser Hajjanjazi of Tehran University and Martin Kramer of Tel Aviv University. Now, on the prospects for political reform in Iran, here is Professor David Menashri.
In my view, at least, the revolution had two major aims. First, to stabilize, institutionalize, consolidate the power of the clerics. And in this sense, until now at least, I think they have been successful. If you look at the political stability and the institutions of the revolution, they are stable. From 1981, when the revolution more or less stabilized, until 89, Iran had the same supreme leader, the same president, the same prime minister, the same president of the Supreme Court, the same speaker of parliament. And then when Ayatollah Khomeini passed away, nothing really happened. Rafsanjani was speaker, became president. Khamenei, who was president, became supreme leader. The president of the Supreme Court was later changed. The position of the prime minister was abolished by the new constitution, and nothing really dramatic happened. And even in 97, when Khatami was elected, and this is not a small thing in the Middle East, that the candidate of the ruling elite is not being elected, Nader Nouri, and an alternative candidate gaining almost 70% of the votes, and actually the stability continued, power was shifted more or less in a routine, regular way. But the second aim of the revolution, in my view, was twofold. First, to translate their ideology into a policy that would elevate, that would solve the problems facing the people. And in this way, to prove that their slogan, Islam is the solution, Islam hu al-hal, is in fact accurate and contains the answers to the needs of the people. Now here, before going on, I will raise three questions that in my view are essential to the understanding of the Islamic Revolution and the politics of Iran. First, we refer to this movement, Islamic Revolution, Islamic regime, and then the question is, and I take heed from what actually Jean said in a different way, in what sense this revolution was Islamic in its roots? Did the people who went to, who really participated in the movement of 1979 were moved by the desire to establish an Islamic regime, or they had other difficulties in mind? And I would very briefly say, in my view, it was a revolution that resulted in Islamic Republic rather than Islamic in its roots. And then it's very complicated what we call religion in the Middle East. Of course, if you use Islamic terminology, everything is Islamic. Education, housing, social gaps, political problems. If you use Western terminology, it was much more than religious movement. It contained everything. People were sick and tired of their situation, and they wanted to see a change for the better. I think the key question, if you ask about the future stability of the regime, is whether or not the problems that were facing the Iranian people, the youth of 79, have been resolved in 2000-2002. So I think we should be careful referring to this phenomenon as religious, because it was, I think, a social, political, cultural movement that aiming to produce a new system and resolve the problems facing the Iranian people. I can say it in a different way. I lived in Iran the last 2 years of the Shah's rule. I could very easily understand the people who are demonstrating against the system and even asking for Khomeini to come to power. But I'm not sure that all people who participated in this movement really wanted this Velayat-e-Faqih system to take power. They had other things on their agenda. The second question is, to what degree the ideology with which Khomeini came to power was Islamic? And then the question is there such a thing that we can refer to as Islamic ideology? And I think the answer was given recently by many Iranian intellectuals, stating very clearly, although there is one Islam, but there is no one interpretation of Islam. There is no one interpretation that is better than the other. There is no final interpretation of Islam. And there can be no official interpretation of Islam. There are, over years, over centuries, there have been so many different interpretations of the laws of Islam, of the Sharia, that what Khomeini produced actually, with the ideology with which he came to power, was by no means the mainstream ideology. Even when he came to power, the leading Ayatollahs in Iran did not really support Khomeini. If you take Ayatollah Shariat Madari, Abdullah Shirazi, and others, the most prominent clerics in Iran did not really follow this ideology. So, in fact, in terms of ideology, it was, I would put it as more as a revolution in Islam rather than Islamic revolution. He changed the interpretation. He brought ideas that existed along the years in the margins of the Islamic establishment, and he put them in the center, and he brought them to power and made them the policy, the ideology of the system in power. But I think we should be careful again and remember that there are many interpretations. And even after Khomeini's coming to power, interpretations continued to be changed. And here is my third question is, to what degree the policy of the Islamic Revolution is loyal to the doctrine with which Khomeini came to power in 79? If we look at the policy, even from the first day of the revolution, we can see that Khomeini himself, with his own blessing, there was a considerable deviation from dogma. And in such a brief presentation, I have to put it very concise, I would say in almost in each and every case in which there was a clash between the interest of the state and the ideology of the revolution, interest won over ideology. It is not in all cases. I think that the way they pursue Salman Rushdie does not help Iranian national interest, but they continue to do it. But there are some exceptions, but as a rule, there is a retreat from dogma. I'll give you one or two examples. And I will specifically give the examples from the early days of the revolution to show that the process did not begin with Khatami. It began with the first year of the revolution. The Iranian constitution says that there is no difference between Muslims. All Muslims are brothers. And all Muslim is one ummah. That's fine. When they come to refer to the Persian Gulf, however, they call the Persian Gulf the Persian Gulf. If you go to Tehran, there to say Al-Khalij al-Arabi, that's be the end of your visit. I think the only people who speak about the Persian Gulf very freely, except the Iranians, are the Israelis. All the others are careful, the Gulf, or what, without mentioning the Persian or the Arab Gulf. Now, when someone offered to Khomeini in 79, let's call the Gulf of the Muslims, Ayatollah Khomeini refused. He said the Gulf has been Persian and will continue to be called Persian. Islam doesn't approve interest. Banking in interest is not forbidden. How you run a country without interest? Now, they've done exactly what we have in Israel, a religious bank. And riba is also forbidden in Judaism, and they found the same solution. They don't call it interest, they call it that you become a shareholder or partner in investment, and you know what, there is a difference between interest and investment. In one word, there is no risk, it is in interest. If the bank guarantees your capital plus a certain amount of income at the end of period, you can call it whatever you want, it is interest. But what can you do? You have to run a country. The retreat from dogma was not voluntarily, however. It was forced on the government. And you can go to 87, 88 and see Khomeini's statements actually preferring the maslaha of the state and establishing this new institution of deciding the interest of the state, Shura-e Tashkhis Maslahat, as actually putting the interest of the state above the ideology of the revolution. The process began much earlier, but was accelerated with Khatami. And here I want to move to Khatami and continue, actually, in a way, what Jing said. And I think I would agree with him in this sense that, first, it was a mistake to think, and I don't know how many people really believe, that Khatami was elected to destroy the system. Khatami was elected to save the system, not to destroy the system. And I think that the other part of what Jill said, I would also agree. I think he has done a great service to the stability of the regime by giving people hope. Actually, what Khatami has done in 97 is the same thing that Khomeini has done in 79. He provided people with hope. The hope that Khomeini gave that he can provide them, he would bring them to the promised land. I don't mean to Palestine, no. He promised to a better life. Khatami actually promised that this can be still done and gain some time, I believe, for the revolution, gave hope to the young people. Now, we use the terms conservatives, reformists, all kind of terminologies, which all of them are very, very difficult and not often accurate. And you know what? The pro-reform camp today have been the most radical people 10, 20 years ago. The people who seize the American embassy are now, many of them, supporting relations with the United States in one way or another. If you look at the people, the Mokhtar Shamipur, he is the leading figure in the marginals of the reform camp, or coordinator of this group in Majlis. He was not considered 10 years ago a reformist. He was the leading radical. And then you can go on to Karoubi, Abdallah Nouri, and others. So the terms are very confusing. The personalities, the people change their attitudes, which is very legitimate. The conflict is between what I would call the spirit of 1979 and the mood of 1997. This is, in my view, the main clash in Iranian society. People who believe that you can still raise the slogans of 79 and with them solve the problems of the Iranian society, and people who believe that these slogans should be put aside, we need new ideas, new way to tackle the harsh problems facing the country. In another word, I would say that there is a clash between what today people call civil society, the young people of Iran, and the institutions of power. So we see here the young people, the people of Iran, on one way, and as against them, the institutions of power. The military, revolutionary guards, the judiciary, which are controlled by the conservative. There was an article in Iranian newspaper, Jame'e, 4 years ago. Jame'e is a society in Persian. It was one of the leading reform newspapers. And an Ayatollah called the young generation, the young people, not to pass certain red lines, red lights, and to obey true Islam. A week later, a young student whom I don't know, answered in a beautiful article. He said that, "I don't know why people who get old tend to forget their youth. We are young and we want good life." And the title of the article was "Pedar Jame'e Javan As," Father, the society is young. And society is also the newspaper's name. And he died young, the newspaper. It was closed later on, shortly after. And then he says that, how many Islams are there that you preach us to obey true Islam or real Islam? And who is there to decide what is the false Islam and the right Islam? But the punchline was the end of this article. It said, the problem is not that we, the young people, are crossing red lines or red lights. The problem is that in a one-way street, you, the conservative clerics, are driving against the flow of traffic. And I think this captures the situation in Iran, when you have the young generation on one hand and then the institutions of power on the other hand. Khatami, I am sure he means well. I was impressed by his writings, by his speeches, by his statements, by his courage, and I even risked my reputation claiming that he can deliver, that he can struggle, that he is a courageous man, and I remembered him from 10 years before, or 7 years, 92, when he resigned from his position as the Minister of Islamic Guidance and Culture. And the letter that he wrote was really a brave letter. Although he was forced to resign, but at least he said what he wanted to, we had to say. But 5 years later, when I checked Khatami's reaction, he was not capable of leading the people who supported him. And I'll give you three examples. And every year, they put him to test, the conservatives. The first time was July 99, student demonstrations in Iran. And one of the slogans was, Khatami, Khatami, where are you? And he was not around for 2 weeks, 12 days actually. He didn't say anything. And this movement was crashed. August 2000, after the election to parliament earlier in the spring, when the reformists won vast majority in parliament, they came to discuss the press law in parliament. And then there was a decree by Ayatollah Khamenei that the majlis is not allowed to discuss this law, and the majlis obeyed, and Khatami did not say much. And July or August 2001, after he was elected again, the first president to gain more votes in his second round than in his first round. Wonderful. Then he was to take oath in parliament. And if you remember, his taking oath was delayed because of controversy between reformists and conservatives over the composition of the Council of Guardians. And again, the reformists had to give up. So you see, July 99, August 2000, August 2001, every test, the reformists had to withdraw and the conservatives actually won. Now, what are the assets that Khatami has? First, the will of people, the support of the people. And ultimately, this line may win, because he represents the will of the people. And Iranian people have decided their history more than any other nation in the Middle East. It was mentioned here about Islamic revolution. Iran had an earlier revolution, the constitutional revolution. If you go before that to the tobacco movement, and then the Mossadegh movement, people are participating, people are influential. And the Islamic revolution was another example. But so far, he didn't manage to really give leadership to this movement and lead to confrontation, basically because, again, he is part of the system. He cannot risk direct confrontation with the system in which he's part of. Khatami had a great deal of support by Iranian intellectuals. I'm not going to give you all the names. You are familiar with them. They are doing a wonderful job to express themselves. One of them, I believe, is now in Boston. There are others in other parts in Iran. And they are really, really courageous people. And they are expressing themselves. And that's, you know, the political system in Iran is very, very interesting. It's not like other places in the Middle East. It was mentioned here, newspapers are publishing things, and then some of them later on in jail, 50 newspapers are closed. It depends which half of the glass you want to look at. If you say 50 liberal newspapers were closed, it's very terrible, but which other country in the Middle East has 50 liberal newspapers? As an Iranian friend told me, David, don't be mistaken, there is a tremendous freedom of expression in Iran. The problem is there is no freedom after expression. But it's deeper than that. It's really, the problem is that if someone like Akbar Ganji writes a book, Talaqiyeh Fashisti az Din wa Hukumat, a fascist interpretation of religion and state, this is something. When Kadivar writes an article, Moshkele Asliye Iran Velayat Fakhiyast, the main problem, the, The essential problem of the Iran today is the system of Velayat-e-Faqih. This is something that you can't hear in other countries of the Middle East so freely, people coming and presented themselves. On the other hand, it was mentioned, I'm not aware that journalists were executed, Jill, but...
No, some of them were shot by the
intellectuals
by
the squads, in
1998.
Yeah. But they were not executed, no. Not publishers or editors of newspapers. So you see these contradictions in Iran. There is a dualism, contradictory pressures. I will conclude by saying what the assets that the conservatives have. Three things. First, they speak in the name of Islam. You know, they come to the people and say, that's what is Islam. They have the authority, people trust them, and actually they have tremendous power by the very fact that they are representing Islam to the people. Second, they have the arms in hand. If you, for example, recall the students' demonstrations and what Ayatollah Mesbahi Yazdi said, how they are going to treat people who do not obey the law or obey the system, and they threatened them. And the Revolutionary Guard say the same thing in different words. So they have, they speak in the name of Islam, they have power in hand, and the third thing, they are determined to fight for their power in society. Unlike the Shah, for example, who did not fight back, the conservatives are really are determined to fight back. So ultimately what we see in Iran is that a revolution which is much more mature than it used to be, a revolution in search of a path, in search of a way, a revolution that is in a deep soul-searching process, and it's caught in this dilemma how to reconcile between the aims of 97 and the situation of 2002. The economic situation is difficult. I know that Patrick is here, he may say a few words about it. But for the common people, to go back to what I started, for the common people of Iran, if you ask them today, is life better today than 22 years ago? For many of them, it is not. The brother of Khamenei was still is the editor of one of the newspapers. Yes. And in his newspaper, there was an article a few years ago saying that using an Islamic hadith, al-hukum, you know, my Arabic used to be better than my Persian, but it's spoiled by the Persian, so lost both of them. But it says that al-hukum yabqa ma'al kufur wa la yabqa ma'al zulum. I mean, the government can sustain under conditions of blasphemy, but it cannot remain in conditions of injustice. And it's going on to say that the situation in Iran today is worse than kufur, it's zulum. So when you have these economic problems, the political problems, the people are really, and if you remember, if you agree that the root of the revolution was social, economic, political, the final stabilization has to do more with resolving the problems which led to the revolution in the first place rather than this or another ideology. Thank you.
Nashri of Tel Aviv University on political reform prospects for Iran. I'm Ted O'Brien, and you're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. Now on the same subject is Huchong Chehabi of Boston University.
One problem that one very often faces looking at Iran is that for the outsider, Iran seems a country so strange that no effort is made to put it in wider comparative perspective. And what I want to point out is that in many ways what we're witnessing in Iran is the playing out of what sociologists call unanticipated consequences. And that is certainly not unique to the Iranian Revolution. When one thinks of the Puritans or the descendants of the Puritans who established American democracy, well, if I had a choice between living in Restoration England or in colonial Massachusetts, I think I would have preferred Restoration England as being far more liberal. And yet it is in America that the descendants of the Puritans wrote the longest-lasting democratic constitution. It is very often observed that Protestant countries had a democracy before Catholic countries did. Well, if one looks at John Calvin and Martin Luther, they were not exactly liberals. So I think there is... something at work in the wider developments in society that one should call unanticipated consequences and perverse effects. And in that sense, it's really not surprising that Iran in 2002, society looks very different from what was intended by the revolutionaries in 1978-1979. And the other point is that in Western democracies, it wasn't as though people suddenly, adversaries of yesterday, sat together and said, well, as of tomorrow, we shall have a democracy, we will tolerate each other. Democracy was born when, within the elites, one had splits, and different factions within the elites decided to take their disputes to the people to arbitrate. And something very similar happened in Iran in the 1980s. Over the various interpretations of religion that was mentioned, factions arose. And given that as a consequence of the constitutional of 1906, it would have been impossible in 1978, 1979 to do away with the parliament. There was a parliament, there were elections, and this factionalism at the elite level was channeled into pre-existing institutions. And that's how one got organizations like the Association of Militant Clergy opposing the Association of Militant Clerics, Tweedledee and Tweedledum for secularists, but nonetheless representative of very different sensibilities within the clergy. And it is as a result of this, again, to some extent replaying the split that had occurred in Western countries, that one gets a certain amount of pluralism at the level of the Iranian political system. This was one point that I wanted to make. I will come immediately to the next point, which is the Khatami election. Here I would depart a little bit from the interpretation that has been given to it. I don't think Khatami was elected so as to serve the Islamic Republic. Saving the Islamic Republic, or at least giving it a new lease of life, may have been an unanticipated consequence of his election. Because for what I know, he didn't think he could win the election. His candidacy was a kind of protest candidacy. He wanted to voice certain ideas. No outside observers thought he had a chance of winning the election. And he has told some friends of mine that if he had known that he would win the election, he wouldn't have run in the first place. In the sense, he wanted to make certain views heard in the political arena, and then, lo and behold, he found himself president of the country. So, again, by doing so, he may have given the Islamic Republic a new lease of life. But I don't think that was the purpose of his candidacy. The next point is about whether he has accomplished something or not. At this point, there's great disappointment. I will agree that Khatami, who seemed to be a very courageous person at this point in Iran, is seen as a coward, actually, because he hasn't used the one asset he has, which is popular support, to confront his adversaries. Is it because he is a man of a system and really doesn't mean what he has been saying for 7 years? I don't think so. I think he just wants to avoid struggle. He wants to avoid confrontation. And if one looks at the political system in Iran, yes, there are certain representative institutions, there are certain elected institutions like the presidency, like parliament, but ultimate power, if one does a close reading of the constitution, ultimate power does not belong to elected institutions. Ultimate power, legislative power, does not belong to parliament because there's an unelected council of guardians that can veto anything. So from the very outset, the reformists are hampered by what philosophers might call an aporia, by an internal contradiction, which is, on the one hand, they say that they want to effect change within the institutions, within the pre-existing institutions. They want to maintain the rule of law. But the existing institutions do not give them the means of going beyond what they have achieved. If you want to stick to the letter of the constitution, you cannot do much more than what Khatami and the reformists have been doing. What one has to do is really use confrontational tactics. Perhaps 2 years after his election, he could have told his supporters to go into the streets and ask in a sort of courteous but firm way the hardliners to give way, because they were still stunned from their defeats. Now it has become very difficult. And it's for that reason that within the political system, the initiative, the sort of the headship of the reformist movement has really shifted from the president to parliament. Because in parliament, one has very gutsy people who keep legislating, knowing full well that the legislation will be vetoed by the Council of Guardians, but they want to be on record for having come up with certain laws that would make life more easy for the average Iranians, and that would bring a modicum of rule of law to the people. In the sense, the mistake that one could make is to think of, because nobody on this panel made that mistake, but very often people from the outside think that Khatami is the leader of the movement. Khatami is not the leader of a movement. Khatami is being carried by a movement. And the moment that he seems to fall behind the movement, he will become irrelevant. And already people in Iran are speaking of transiting through the Khatami stage, because he is being seen as having been a disappointment. Yes, he was voted, he was re-elected with more votes than the first time. That is true, but by then the electorate had grown by 14 million people, and we have a much higher abstention rate in the second round than in the first round. So between the 1997 and 2001, millions of Iranians had given up hope of being able to change things from within. Those were the people who abstained. Of course, another reason why they may have abstained is because they thought that Khatami would win anyways, because there was no credible candidate against him, so why bother going to stand in line and vote if you know what the outcome will be. 1997, 20 million votes. 2001, 21 million votes with 13 million abstentions. That is very important. And just to take the devil's advocate, I also do not think that it is quite right to say that nothing has changed in Iran. A lot has changed between 1997 and today. Obviously, the major structures of power are still there, are still controlled by the conservatives. But if you look at the daily lives of people, even though, of course, people grumble and people are, you know, upset, there have been little improvements. I noticed this because I went to Iran in 1997, shortly after Khatami's first election, and I went back in June 2001 to be there during his second election. So for 4 years, I hadn't been there. And if change comes gradually, one doesn't really notice it if one lives there. But if there's a hiatus of 4 years, then you notice certain difference. I mean, one of the differences is immigration. When one entered or left the country, there were always two or three controls. Now one goes through in about 10 or 20 seconds. So what I'm trying to say is that while the reformers may not control the legislative branch of government, while they certainly do not control the judiciary, they have had a certain impact on administration. And the administration has tried to become slightly more responsive to people's needs, slightly more accountable to people's needs. And one of the big things that are always overlooked is that for the first time in history, Iranian towns and villages have elected municipal councils and elected mayors. This means that there's a certain participation rate at the local level, which is a sine qua non for developing a democracy. And when the question is which road should be paved first, or which village should be connected to the main city in the province first, then factional disputes over ideology don't really matter. But it allows people nonetheless to exercise their rights as citizens and to have a certain input, at least in local government. And so I think one of the big changes of the Khatami presidency is precisely the introduction of local councils, you know, which may work in some places, in other places they don't work at all. but it's important that these institutions be there. Another important sort of structural change, which is important, which whose importance again is very often overlooked, is that for the first time in Iranian history, really, votes are counted honestly. This is very important because we all know about the kind of totalitarian third world elections where the ruling party gets 99.99%. This is out of fashion because of the demise of communism, but we still do have elections where the ruling party, you know, stuffs the ballot box and so on. And in Iran, there is enough of a pluralism at the electoral scene that representatives of different associations gather at the ballot box to keep an eye and make sure that the other group doesn't falsify the election results. And I think procedure, at the level of procedure, this is a major revolution, which is actually maybe even more important than who is actually in power. The fact that votes are counted more or less honestly. And one other point that I wanted to add, again, in broad agreement, is that one consequence of the revolution that is very often overlooked is that it has led to a far greater degree of social integration. Professor Gilles Kepel mentioned the kind of gap that existed between the north of Tehran and the south of Tehran, the poor people living in the south, the rich people in the north. As precisely a French geographer, Bernard Urquhart, has shown in his works, yes, the north-south divide is still there, but they're vast middle-class suburbs in the east and the west of Tehran. So in addition to having a polarized north and south, Tehran now has an east and a west. And it's precisely these repressive, puritanical policies of the early years of the Islamic Republic, of the 1980s, that have contributed to lessening the gap between culturally cosmopolitan westernized Iranians and more traditional Iranians, because far more traditional people now go to university on the one hand, far more traditional people now get an education on the one hand, especially women, and on the other hand, members of the cosmopolitan westernized segment of the Iranian population going through the same educational system are now far more exposed to religion than they used to be. So there is a coming together, if you like, of people across the cultural gap that was such an important manifestation of pre-revolutionary society, and which explains why in the reformist movement today you find secular reformists struggling shoulder to shoulder with religious liberals. You find liberal Islamists proclaiming that they feel much closer to secularists, to liberal secularists, not to supporters of the Yang Shah, but to liberal secularists, than they feel to totalitarian Islamists. And you find informally journalists helping each other. When a secular journal is closed down, you find people from the religious sector sort of telling the secularists how they can stand their own in a religious court so that they can get the newspaper opened again. And this kind of integration is a very important thing, which actually bodes quite well for the future. Now, the problem, obviously, is that under the existing institutions, there's no way out of the present deadlock. Because, as I said, if one wants to stick by the letter of the Constitution, there is no way that elected officials are going to become more powerful than the unelected organs of the state, which are in the hands of the hardliners. So it's really a case of the... I always get this wrong, the unstoppable object meeting the immovable obstacle, because there is a genuine deadlock. And this deadlock has to be broken from outside the system, and it's difficult to imagine what form breaking the deadlock would take. So if I had to make a prediction, my prediction would be there will be more of the same for quite some time to come.
Professor Hucheng Chehabi on prospects for political reform in Iran. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. We now hear from two speakers with sharply contrasting views, especially as regards Israel, on Iran's regional perspective. First, from Professor Martin Kramer of Tel Aviv University, followed by Professor Nasser Hajjanjazi of Tehran University. Professor Kramer.
I remind you that Khomeini had declared his war on Israel back in January 1979, which was 3.5 years before Israel invaded Lebanon. As long as Iran's interest remains the pursuit of this proxy war, especially if it is conducted as a proxy war, Hezbollah will be on its front line, wherever that line might be, even if it is Israel's border. Now, there were others who argued otherwise. Here, for example, is the 1999 opinion of a study of Hezbollah's foreign policy published by the Council on Foreign Relations, and I want to quote it. Hezbollah's social base will simply not support attacks into Israel. Given the likely costs of retribution, Hezbollah has no appetite to launch a military campaign across the Israeli border should Israel withdraw from the south, whether unilaterally or as a result of negotiations with Lebanon and Syria. End of quote. That's from 1999. I think in retrospect, this optimistic assessment was based on wishful thinking of the sort that generally infected the academic study of Islamist movements. These movements were invariably presented as moderate or moderating. Hezbollah was no exception. Even the notion that Hezbollah might have its own foreign policy as distinct from Iran's, it reflected a kind of giddy optimism that even this most radical or most pan-Islamic of movements could not resist the gravity of local nationalism, even the weak gravity of a battered entity called Lebanon. I think Hezbollah has resisted it. Here we are following a unilateral withdrawal by Israel of all its forces to a line marked and certified by the United Nations. And what do we have? We have Hezbollah launching intense attacks across the UN blue line against the Israeli positions in the Sheba Farms, which is part of the Golan Heights occupied by Israel since 1967. Hezbollah has used an old Lebanese claim to this area as a pretext for continuing to mount the same kinds of operations that it mounted when Israel did occupy Lebanon. Up and down the border, it has conducted surveillance and training operations, which have contributed to raising tensions. It regularly fires anti-aircraft guns over northern Israel. It seems to have facilitated at least one Palestinian cross-border attack of the kind Israel had not experienced since the 1970s. And it has stockpiled enormous quantities of short and medium-range rockets, which put one of Israel's major urban centers, Haifa, within range. So Hezbollah has basically put in place an entire infrastructure for conceivably, under some circumstances, opening another front against Israel, this time along the border itself. Now, how is this in the interest of Lebanon or of Hezbollah's social base? Most likely it isn't, but it may well be in the interest of Iran. The conclusion, I think, from Hezbollah's conduct since the Israeli withdrawal is that Lebanonization of the movement was something of an illusion. I think it perhaps was deliberately foisted on the world by some in Iran and Hezbollah and was believed by countless experts who wanted to believe. Now, of course, it does not end there. Iran, with some help from Hezbollah, has been working to keep elements in the Palestinian Intifada well-armed and well-equipped. Iran mentored one Palestinian Islamist movement. This is the Islamic Jihad, which in its early years actually openly professed fealty to Ayatollah Khomeini and its ideological platform. It is a small movement, but it does play an important role. It is, by the way, the group that dominated the Jenin refugee camp. These were the people who fought unto the death this past month. Relations with Hamas have been less intimate, but certainly friendly. The Hamas embassy in Tehran effectively represents Palestine there. And, of course, you must have mentioned in the course of the morning the Karin A affair, the armed ship loaded in Iran and sent to the Palestinian Authority, Iran being the sender, the PA being the receiver of a shipment that could have conceivably taken the Intifada to a new strategic level. To my mind, the denials that have issued from Iran are no more persuasive than those issued by the Palestinian Authority. The plain fact is that from an Iranian point of view, the present Intifada is a great opportunity to extend their role to new clients, not just Hezbollah, not just the Palestinian Islamists, but to elements in the Palestinian Authority itself. Now, at a conference I organized a few years back, the French Iranologist Olivier Roy was asked by a questioner whether Iran's support for the liberation of Jerusalem was just a fig leaf for a changing revolution. And Roy gave a memorable answer. It was not a fig leaf, he said, it was a fig tree. Not being an expert on Iranian domestic politics, I don't purport to know exactly what this fig tree is supposed to conceal. I do know that this fig tree is now covered with leaves and that these days the Iranians seem to be very much enjoying the figs. And I tend to take seriously statements like that of the head of the reformist faction in the Iranian parliament. We all know who that is. Made on January 9th, and I quote him, "It is in the strategic interest of Iran to aid the Palestinian Intifada until the process of establishing a Palestinian state is completed. This will only be possible when there are no Jews left in all of Israel." End of quote. Now, there may be people in Iran who think that it isn't in Iran's strategic interest to support the Intifada via Hezbollah solidarity operations against Israel or adventures like the Karine A. If there are, they certainly aren't winning the debate. Perhaps we are deluding ourselves to think that they might. In the meantime, Iranian leaders continue to make weird or wily statements about nuclear weapons. You'll discuss this later. And their possible use against Israel. If it hasn't been mentioned today, and there may be some students here, so I'll do it for their benefit, I will mention Ayatollah Rafsanjani's famous nuclear speech on the last Al-Quds Day on December 14th, and I quote him, "If one day the Islamic world will also be equipped with the weapons that Israel has, the designs of the oppressors will reach a deadlock, since the use of one atomic bomb against Israel would totally destroy Israel, while the same against the Islamic world would only cause damage. Such a scenario is not inconceivable." End of quote. Now, I will not do a close analysis of this statement. Many people have tried. I would only note that here, too, Iranian leaders get away with statements that no other leaders could dare to make. Imagine if a former Israeli president gave a speech and announced that a multi-pronged nuclear attack could destroy Iran and that this scenario is not inconceivable. He would be denounced everywhere as a madman. So I conclude. While the experts do battle on the future direction of Iran's revolution, speculating here, speculating there, in the Arab-Israeli arena, Iran's actions seem fairly straightforward. Iran continues to act in precise accord with a strategic plan to intrude itself in such a way that it could, if it found it to be in its interests, encourage a heightened conflict or war. It continues to ally itself with those who seek the perpetual conflict, providing them with moral and material means. I editorialize. If the Arab-Israeli zone is ever to be stabilized, there will be no alternative to pruning Iran's fig tree. If there ever is to be a peace, I think it will have to be cut down completely. It isn't too early to sharpen the axes. Hopefully it isn't too late, and it would be most desirable if the Iranians were to do it themselves. So thank you. I'll leave it there.
First of all, I mean, in regard to Iran's power and its strength in the Lebanese and the Arab-Israeli conflict, believe me, conservatives love, exactly, radicals love what you said. They would love to see that they have such a power there, that they can exercise such a tremendous power over there. But the reality is that's not true. In regard to Hezbollah attack to Israel after Israeli withdrawal from Lebanese territory, as you mentioned, Martin, I mean, it has been basically limited to the Shabwa Farm area. In other words, Hezbollah have been relatively restrained, not attacking anywhere else. And just last week, in fact, when there was a chance of such an attack, Kharrazi was there. And Kharrazi asked from the Hezbollah to exercise a restraint. Thus, Iran's interest will not be served by Hezbollah attack to Hezbollah attacks to Israel. What sort of interest possibly Iran can have in that one? This is the first. And as even Dick Norton, you know, has mentioned, and many others as well. Hezbollah is becoming and transforming to become a political party, mostly a political party, inside Lebanon. There is just very tiny minority among them, which are still radical, and they want to exercise sort of radicalism. Otherwise, basically, it is a political force within Lebanese society which try to work for the rights of Shia in Lebanon. In regard to Hamas and Jihad, that's a totally different case. As you mentioned, in regard to Jihad, the affinity is stronger there than to Hamas. But again, we have to look at the domestic situation in Iran. Just 2 months ago, that has been the case probably at least last 4 or 5 years, but it crystallized particularly since two months ago, or in fact, probably a very important expression of it was last month, when a majority of the Iranian Congress demonstrated in front of Palestinian embassy in support of Palestine, but they attempted hard, openly, publicly, to distinguish themselves from the minority or the radicals in the Majlis, in making the point that they are pro-two-state solution there. They are supporting Arafat, and they very explicitly mentioned that they would like to see democratic forces in Palestine get the power, not the radicals. They did not mention Hamas or Jihad, but what they meant basically was we would like to support democratic forces in Palestine in the future.
Professor Nasser Hajjanjazi of Tehran University, you've been listening to excerpts from Iran, Another Look, a one-day conference held earlier this week at Boston University. Join us next week for a special broadcast as we present the Boston University Opera Institute production of Johann Strauss' opera, Die Fledermaus, in its entirety. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild with help from Mike Toda and Tina Tobey. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.